This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 60 was recorded on September 22nd, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Ever since the repo facility blew up last week, our inbox has been overwhelmed with requests for an update from Jeff Snyder. So we've got Jeff ready to go for you. Even took time out of his Sunday afternoon to pre-record this so we could get it out first thing on Monday morning. Jeff put together a fantastic slide deck that goes with today's discussion, and I strongly encourage you to download it as we'll be discussing the graphs and charts which it contains in detail. You'll find the download link next to Jeff's picture in the description of this article on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Jeff, just over a month ago, we were talking about Fed funds moving above IOER, the repo market, ceilings and floors, target ranges, and all of that stuff, which at the time just seemed like, you know, money market minutia that wasn't all that relative to current events. Well, guess what? Stuff just got real, and all of a sudden, it's quite relevant to current events. And I remember you saying that something must be going on with money markets, because to sum it up, you said things just weren't working the way they should have been working when we saw that funny behavior between Fed funds and IOER. So at the time, it wasn't really clear how that related to what else was going on in the market. But now, all of the sudden, we're seeing these crazy spikes in repo rates, and it's freaking the Federal Reserve out. It's very clear from a distance that they're not really sure exactly what's going on here. So needless to say, quite a few of our listeners thought, wait a minute, Snyder was talking about that a month ago. Now, all this happened just a few days before the Fed announcement. Jay Powell said that these funding pressures are just because of some technical factors, and they have no implications for the economy. But based on the size of the move and the attention that this has gotten in the media, it's not so easy to just take his word on it.
Yeah, that's right, Eric. And the truth is, this couldn't have come at a worse time for the Fed. If we start out on slide three, you know, Powell has been trying to claim that the economy needs a few rate cuts, even though it really doesn't need any rate cuts. That's what he's really been saying. And then, you know, leading up to the second rate cut announcement last week, he has money markets become headline news all over the place. And now he's trying to say that everything is fine in money markets, but the Fed is responding, you know, just kind of in case. So he's really trying to thread a very fine needle to maintain optimism while at the same time delivering something that he believes is positive. Like I always say, you know, monetary policy these days is about managing expectations because central bankers don't fully understand how this modern system works. You know, as I said the last time we got together, they don't really speak the language. So monetary policy now is all about keeping everyone's spirits up. But it's becoming a whole lot harder to make the claim that everything is really fine and we're only acting out of an abundance, an overabundance really of caution. So when we're observing the system, we need to go off what the data is telling us, not what the Fed or the financial media is saying. And when we can't get hard evidence, you know, we can start by at least asking some simple questions and try to infer what's going on from there. You know, everyone should be asking themselves, if one of the basic functions of a central bank is to be lender of last resort, why are we now seeing the Fed need to step up and play this role for the first time since 2008? You know, what is it that's going on beyond the normal operations of the market that brought us to this point?
Well, Jeff, that's why we have you here. So among these so-called technical factors, I've heard some people saying things about coupon settlements and corporate tax collections, putting temporary stress on funding markets. Now, are these things relevant to the symptoms that we're seeing?
Yeah, that's part of the story. There are seasonal low points strewn throughout the calendar. It's just the way things are. You know, real life has these kinds of bottlenecks that show up where you can get distracted or limited. You know, 2 weeks before the end of each quarter, that's what happens in these money markets. It's a lull. In the third quarter, there's a few extra seasonal factors related to tax collections in the federal government. It is essentially just a low point for liquidity. But here's the thing. Everyone knows there's a low point, and they know exactly where it is on the calendar, and they even know how much of an effect it is supposed to have ahead of time. This was not some big surprise. So why did it turn out to be such a big event? You know, if there are these calendar bottlenecks every year, why did this particular one create so much disorder? You know, Lehman Brothers was the same thing, a day in September, 2 weeks before the end of the third quarter of 2008. Now, I'm not saying this is like 2008, only that like Lehman, the events surrounding the regular calendar bottleneck that year and this year, they turned out to be a bigger deal than normal. So in neither case was it because of the regular calendar bottleneck.
Okay, Jeff, so what you're saying is that all those factors that people are talking about, they all make sense, but it's well known. Everybody knew in advance that this was coming, and we've been through this before. It happens, you know, it's like they say, it happens each spring. Well, it happens at the end of each quarter. So therefore, something else has to be going on, and you were saying that when we talked about this a few weeks ago. So what's going on?
Right. You know, if there was a seasonal low point, it turned out to be a lot lower than anyone thought it would be, then that says there's an underlying constraint, some additional factor to take into account. Now, when conditions start to tighten for whatever reason, you know, be it abnormal or a predictable calendar bottleneck, we count on dealer banks to fill in the gaps. You know, a seasonal bottleneck is something they can plan for and work their surpluses around in anticipation. So they're supposed to have spare capacity to act when things go out of alignment. The word everyone throws around is reserves, and there's a reason why they are called that. You know, when the repo rate rises, for example, for whatever reasons, whether it's, you know, dealers should be in the market right away, taking advantage of any spread. They're supposed to have dry powder or spare capacity to be able to do that. You know, and that, Eric, that was our point in that discussion, our last discussion, when we talked about Fed funds and IOER, how even several months ago, in fact, if you go back to March, as I'm showing here on slide four, there were growing indications that dealers were becoming shy about repo and Fed funds, even though the spreads were getting higher and higher. And so when you infer from that, you know, there was not much, if any, spare capacity. And then last week, starting on Monday, it exploded. And by and large, the dealers just sat there. So it wasn't something new. The scale of the imbalance was new last week, but the pattern was exactly the same.
Okay, if these dealer banks largely sat out those few days last week, was it because they didn't want to act or because there's something going on that was preventing them from acting? Or is that even a meaningful distinction?
Yeah, when you get right down to the heart of the matter, it's all about this shyness, which again, isn't new. It's been building for more than a year and a half. You know, that's how long we've been talking about Fed funds, IOER, and all that other stuff. Almost since Jay Powell's first day in office, really. And it keeps growing in scale and scope as the more time passes. It gets more out of alignment, not less. It's an escalating series of problems.
Okay, Jeff. So as I've learned to expect from you, and I think many of our listeners have as well, you've got a completely different read on what's really behind this move. Aside from the one-off factors, the most common explanation that I've heard so far is that the government is adding to its general cash account, and that's what's flooding the market with treasuries. Meanwhile, this is happening in an environment where there are too few excess reserves because of quantitative tightening. Now, is that a credible explanation?
It's worthwhile to lay this view out in more detail. You know, what some people are trying to say is that it's all because of the federal government. You know, the tax reform law of December 2017 led to bigger fiscal deficits, which has meant more U.S. Treasury securities, especially T-bills, that have been auctioned off and that dealers have to finance. More recently, because of the debt ceiling arrangement, the Treasury is now rebuilding its cash reserves, leading to even more issuance on top of that prior deluge. So dealers by law have been required to buy up all of these securities at auction. You know, that's their first part, the primary and what makes them primary dealers. So the general idea is that dealers are getting stuck holding the bag. The law is forcing them to buy up more and more treasuries that have to be funded in some way. And where do dealers fund their inventory? It's in the repo market. So more dealers get stuck with treasuries, a lot more treasuries. There's more demand for repo, meaning higher repo rates and therefore Fed funds too. If you look at it on slide five, you know, we add to that the Fed's balance sheet normalization, or what people are inaccurately call quantitative tightening, and that has meant less supply of bank reserves at the same time. So dealers have been hit from both sides, and that's why people are saying dealers are being constrained.
Basically, an oversupply of treasuries and scarcity of reserves to fund dealers' purchases of those new treasuries. And you don't buy that argument. Now, I've got to say, it does make a lot of sense. I know that there are a lot of smart people who agree with it.
Yeah, I know. And that's what's so frustrating. I think it's only because there's no other explanation out there, or, you know, not enough of a full, complete alternative. you're forced by Jay Powell into choosing essentially between two partial options. Either everything is absolutely fine, like he says, which as more time passes, the more it becomes clear that's just not true, or it has to be this deficit dealer QT thing. The latter at least appears to fit some of the facts, whereas Powell's hopeless optimism evidently doesn't fit any of the facts. So like you summed up, Eric, you know, more demand for repo financing, a lower supply of reserves to provide cash for collateral would mean a higher price, or in this case, a higher repo rate. So in the absence of an explanation which, you know, which fits all of the facts, the partial one is the one that everybody is turning to. And I'm not entirely dismissing these supply and demand dynamics either. There may be some truth in them, but if you look at the data, it still leaves at least one big basic fact unexplained. You know, dealer inventories have been rising in stages all the way going back to the great financial crisis, even when we had supposedly abundant reserves and a much, much smaller fiscal deficit. If you go to slide six, for example, you know, we've seen these spikes in the repo rate that show up in, under these similar periods where dealers are building inventory. This is not the first time this has happened. And so these simple facts raise just one question. Are dealers being stuck with U.S. Treasuries, or are they choosing to hoard them? And you asked before if there was a difference, and there absolutely is.
Well, yeah, there certainly is between forced to hold treasuries and hoarding them because they're scared of something and aren't telling what they're scared of. So if everyone else, Jeff, or just about everyone else, is claiming that what's going on here is dealers are being forced by the government to effectively finance bigger deficits, as Luke Roman has described, which means that they have to hold more treasuries. They're just unwilling victims of this. From what I'm hearing, you think it's actually the opposite. You think that banks know something they're not telling. I don't know if I'm reading something into it to say that, but you think they're choosing to hold more treasuries. That begs the question, why are they choosing to hold more treasuries? What are they afraid of?
Well, you know, if you think that they're being forced to, it says that the federal government, along with QT, is the real culprit, and therefore it's easy to fix. You fix it by getting spending back on track and end QT. Maybe even starting QE if you want to. Now, the Fed already ended QT a couple months ago, and so that's already taken care of. But, you know, if it's the latter, or what's my view, then the problem is much bigger and far harder, if not impossible, to address under the current framework, as you alluded to, Eric. You know, and we know exactly which one of the two it is, and it's not my verdict. It's the market's verdict. You know, while dealer banks, they are statutorily obligated to buy government bonds at auction, there is no law that says they have to hold these securities or for how long. Once they fulfilled that original obligation, dealers are free to dispose of them at their pleasure. Therefore, if you're going to claim that dealers are being stuck with treasuries, you have to simultaneously claim that it's because they cannot sell them. And in this market, that is quite frankly ridiculous. I mean, there is overwhelming demand in the marketplace for these same securities. So, you know, if dealers are having any sort of trouble selling treasuries at a time when the financial public cannot seem to buy enough of them, and seemingly at any price, then these are the most inept banks that have ever operated in human history. I mean, the entire dealer business is set up to do just this thing, to buy at auction and then sell to the financial public. You know, and the dealers could not have dreamed up a better scenario than this. The government is supplying a huge volume that doesn't seem to be able to satiate any demand for it. And that makes all the difference in the world. You know, it takes things from a technical matter of government financing and the supply of reserves, or QT, and makes it a systemic issue for the entire global system, a systemic monetary issue for the entire global system. And again, the market has spoken unequivocally on this point. If dealers are holding a ton of treasuries in their inventory, and they are, that part is absolutely true. It cannot be because they are forced into it. They have to be choosing to do so.
Okay, Jeff, so that must be what we're seeing reflected in these repo numbers, right? Because from what I can see, and to your point, it makes no economic sense to buy two-year treasuries yielding less than, let's say, 1.8%, and then have to pay something like 2.3% or maybe a lot more in repo costs. But at the same time, that 1.8% yield also means that there has to be tremendous demand for that two-year throughout the entire marketplace. So, Jeff, this whole thing doesn't add up. I mean, economically, it makes sense that the dealers ought to want to sell that paper to the next guy who really, really, really wants to buy it. And clearly, they do want to buy it. But the dealers are not doing that. They're choosing instead to absorb those higher repo costs that don't make sense given the economics of the yield.
Yeah, Eric, and it's not just the funding costs. If we go to slide 7, we also have to factor that dealers are giving up opportunity costs all up and down the spectrum that they should be willing to take on too. If you didn't really want that 2-year, you know, sell it to the marketplace at likely an enormous profit from where you bought it, and then park the funds someplace else. Lend them in repo, for example. And instead of getting less than 1.8% by holding a government security, turn it around the other way and you get 2.3% or better collateralized by a government security if you're lending them in repo. But in order to do that, as a dealer, you have to have the capacity and the willingness to be on the lending end of repo, which is very different from owning and possessing a government bond. There's something special about possessing that government bond. There has to be something enormously valuable in doing so. Otherwise, you know, dealers wouldn't be absorbing all of these costs and not taking advantage of all of these other opportunities that are afforded them because they are choosing, they're absolutely choosing to hold on to these treasuries.
This is also something that we talked about just a few weeks ago, Jeff, the other side of repo, so to speak. What we've discussed so far, if I'm following you correctly, is the cash side. But from what I know about repo, there's also a collateral side. Government bonds, particularly the best of the best, are those like Germany's in even U.S. treasuries. And what makes the best of the best has nothing to do with the issuer's fundamental characteristics. I mean, there's a world of difference in the credit profile of the German government versus the U.S. government. It's night and day. And yet in repo, both of those types of securities are given exactly the same place at the top of the hierarchy. So is there something going on here where maybe the role that these securities play in the repo market is affecting what's happening?
Yeah, and that's what you have to keep in mind when it comes to repo and what makes U.S. Treasury so special. You're right. It isn't the fundamentals, which, by the way, are atrocious and getting worse. Nobody denies that. In repo, none of that matters. All that matters to the repo counterparty who is accepting collateral for cash is the liquidity characteristics of the asset. How much can it move in price while it is in their possession? What's the short-run tail risk? It's a parallel element of flight to safety. You know, in times of trouble, no matter how much you have to hold your nose, everyone goes into treasuries as well as German bonds. The market just accepts that these are the best liquidity characteristics, and therefore they are extra special repo collateral. And over the past year and a half, while we've been witness to that slow burn in Fed funds related to capacity, we've also seen some things in the treasury and bond markets, the German bond markets, related to these collateral characteristics. And I'm specifically, if you go on slide 8 here, I'm referring specifically to May 29 of last year.
Right. I remember that was back when everyone said that the bond bull market was officially over, that inflation, growth, and a more aggressive Jay Powell were all going to lead interest rates far, far higher. And then, seemingly out of nowhere, interest rates fell sharply, unusually so.
Exactly. And it wasn't just treasury yields. It was also, in particular, German bond yields. So while everything was supposedly going right in the world, suddenly there was this big signal beyond Fed funds that said something must have just gone really wrong. A very serious and acute rush into what still are the best forms of collateral anywhere in the world. And that was just the beginning, quite literally the beginning. If you go to slide 9, if you look at every single chart that matters, from inflation expectations to swap spreads and a whole lot in between, May 29, 2018 shows up as an inflection point in all of them. Before May 29, markets were sort of moving in that other direction, you know, optimism and a little positivity. But after May 29, it has been the complete opposite. The world is getting darker and more dangerous with just a little more, you know, just a little more each and every passing week and month. So that by, you know, September 2019, we're still discussing repo and Fed funds. But the key difference last week was that before it was basically just, you know, maybe you, me, and 6 other people who had been talking about repo and Fed funds. And now suddenly everyone is talking about repo and Fed funds.
Which again means that what happened last week wasn't something that just showed up out of the blue. Macro Voices listeners have known, we didn't know exactly that this event was coming, but we knew that something was funny in these markets just from listening to your All-Stars appearances. It may have been a surprise to most people, but clearly it's been in the works. We know that from the interviews you've done. There's no way you could have predicted this. So if there's a progressively worsening situation, which you say and the entire bond market seems to agree, is that these dealer banks, for some reason, are holding on to more and more of the best possible repo collateral by choice. They're doing it intentionally. There has to be a reason for that, and nobody's telling the reason.
All of that indicates that there's a much bigger repo problem, but one that's more aligned on the collateral side and not necessarily the reserve side where everybody's focused. You know, and that's a much stickier constraint, especially when we are talking about spare capacity and the ability of dealers to step in and redistribute funding when it's needed. As I said before, you know, that's the market's verdict, not mine. Take Eurodollar futures, for example. 2 weeks, just 2 weeks after May 29, the Eurodollar futures curve inverted for the first time, as you can see on slide 10. That was this market predicting that things had materially changed so that after that point, it began pricing, the Eurodollar futures market began pricing that there was a non-trivial chance the Fed would start cutting rates at some point in the intermediate future. And remember, this was June 2018, amidst all of the hysteria and hawkishness. You know, the idea that Powell was going to have to start cutting rates was absurd at the time, but that's just what has happened. So the Eurodollar futures market was absolutely right about that very fact. Something big happened on May 29th in the middle of 2018, and it had to do with collateral and repo. So, you know, in the summer of 2018, while everyone's still talking about inflation and rate hikes, you know, the Fed made a statement to the effect that, hey, pay no attention to the bond market, as you can see in slide 11. That's just this, quote, strong worldwide demand for safe assets. So even back then, the Fed was admitting that there was what they thought was unusually huge demand for these kinds of bonds.
Well, and then not long after that, the whole Treasury curve inverted starting in November of last year, which I guess just meant an even stronger worldwide demand for safe haven assets. And, oh, by the way, gold surprised a lot of people, myself included, by breaking out. So everybody suddenly wants safe haven assets, Jeff. What's going on here?
Yeah, and that's very significant too, especially you point out gold that we talked about not long ago either. You know, all this dollar shortage business predates the inversion of the Treasury curve. In fact, the strong worldwide demand for safe assets, that's the very reason the curve inverted in the first place. You could see it coming in the bond market. The bond market has been saying all along, going back to early 2018, that there is building strain and that as more time passes, the more serious and open it becomes. So the dollar problem caused the inversion, not the other way around, as some people are now trying to allude to and claim. You know, I've seen references too to something that, you know, somebody called a dollar black hole that is supposedly due to the inversion, since that means parking collateral in the Fed's foreign reverse yields more than buying the long end. Again, this might have some truth to it, you know, this other explanation, but the basic cause and effect is backwards. The yield curve inversion wasn't something like the hand of God redrawing Treasury rates upside down and forcing dealers to deal with it. It was the dealers themselves going into overdrive in their strong worldwide demand for safe assets. That's what redrew the yield curve.
Okay, Jeff, hang on. I want to jump in here because I know that you're going to be tempted to dive into the details of this black hole hypothesis. Might be a great topic for a future interview, but that's getting a little bit ahead of how much time we have available today. So I want to keep it focused. So let's bring this back to the events of last week and sum up our main points. Repo rates explode, surprising most people. This means what?
Yeah, what happened last week was a combination of the seasonal bottleneck running up against this underlying constraint, which, you know, was impossible to predict and factor. Banks had assumed it would be covered, but then found out very quickly that the dealers weren't going to be there. And also, you know, more importantly, perhaps, they found out the Fed wasn't there either. You know, we'll have to talk about that at another time, too. You know, those overnight repo operations that the Fed carried out last week had very little, if any, effect at all. As a colleague of mine pointed out using the SOFR figures, which is the alternate money rate that everybody's trying to switch over to, there was over $900 billion of funding on last Tuesday that cleared at rates above 5%, even though the Fed had conducted its first overnight repo operation that morning, which amounted to $53 billion. So it didn't get much better on Wednesday or Thursday. And the only reason conditions stopped being so outrageous was because the bottleneck simply passed. You know, it wasn't the overnight repo operations that restored order. The Fed was just lucky this wasn't an actual systemic event along the lines of something like 2008. It was, however, a dress rehearsal for one, and you better believe that money market participants took full note of how disorganized and chaotic it had become at certain points. You know, and then you have to believe also that might factor into choosing to hold more treasuries moving forward, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so I guess that means you must think that Jay Powell may not have been totally on the level when he said last week at his press conference that these funding pressures have no bearing on the economy or monetary policy. No big deal, technicalities, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, no one at the Fed is ever going to admit when anything is a big deal. In fact, the bigger the deal it is, the less likely any official will ever confirm it as much. But we already know that it was in two very important ways. Number one, the overnight repo operations are going to continue. The Fed announced that late last week. And if you go to slide 12, they also made another technical adjustment to IOER, with the fourth now in over the last year and a half, lowering an additional 5 basis points. And oh, by the way, they also made their first technical adjustment to the RRP. But like those prior adjustments, this doesn't seem to change participants' behavior. And EFF, even this week, late last week, remains well above IOER. It's elevated. More recently, they've been talking about going to a standing repo facility because this problem just won't go away. And so what was announced on Friday isn't quite a standing repo facility, but it's moving in that direction. So that there will be overnight auctions going forward that are, importantly, we have to point out, going to be supplemented by term auctions, which are the kind of thing you only do if you're worried about low liquidity that might get right at the quarter end, which is, by the way, the next seasonal bottleneck. Number two, the big picture on slide 13, when all of this repo stuff started, May 29, the Eurodollar futures curve predicting Jay Powell's rate cuts almost a year before he even considered them himself, everything was supposed to be looking up. It was inflation, booming growth, and rate hikes, as we said before, as far as the eye could see, everything was going to be great. And the bond market would implode and everybody would applaud. Instead, we now have 2 rate cuts. We have no sense of inflation anywhere. In fact, long-term inflation expectations have collapsed again. And very real questions about a possible global recession on the horizon. And the bond market, quite frankly, is pissing everyone off by behaving the same way as it had frequently during the last 12 years, which indicated only bad things and only bad potential. Now, Powell says these funding pressures don't matter. If he was specifically talking about the calendar bottleneck, then, he would be right. But after last week, it's finally becoming clear in a mainstream sense that, these funding pressures probably do matter.
Okay, Jeff, I want to pull these things all together now and put them in context, because frankly, I don't mind admitting that some of the intricacies of how the repo market works and some of the stuff that you and Luke Groman argue about, it's a little bit over my pay grade. But if I step back from this, it just seems like there's a really clear message here, which is, hey, wait a minute. I'm not smart enough to explain all of the whys and wherefores, but there were a lot of really smart people that thought that that backup in yields was going to keep going. And all of a sudden, we see this reversal where everybody just can't buy enough treasuries. Now we've got irrational behavior where if you look at the business that banks are supposedly in, they've got a profit opportunity to resell the paper that they're buying that everybody is saying that they're being forced to buy that they don't want. There's people waiting to buy it from them at a profit, and they're not doing it. Gold broke out despite the fact that a lot of us had good reason to be skeptical and didn't think that it would. The dollar has surprised a lot of people. There's just so many things that have safe haven asset initialed on them, reflected on them, have anything to do with it. All of a sudden, we're seeing a whole bunch of stuff that nobody can explain. And if there's anything that I get out of this, out of the government reaction to this, they don't know what's going on. All of this Jay Powell standing up and being confident and saying, oh, this is just a minor technicality, it's not important. They never saw this coming. They don't know what's happening here. You said earlier in this interview, Jeff, oh, I don't want to scare people. I'm not saying it's 2008. Well, look, we don't know that it's 2008, but in terms of like a Lehman moment-sized something bad in the economy coming, we don't know that it's that, but it seems like there's awfully good circumstantial evidence to say something really screwy is happening here. Am I reading too much into it to think that?
Yeah, I would agree with you, Eric, and I think that's been our message all along. Number one, the Fed, they have no idea what's going on here. I mean, we talked about it with Luke Groman. They don't speak the monetary language, and they haven't for such a very long time, which has been my consistent message for, 15, 20 years now. They don't know what's going on in the monetary system. And you can see the last week, they just kind of threw a bunch of stuff at the wall and hoped something fit, something just stuck. That's not really a good way to run a central bank, but that's kind of the way things go at the time. But to your larger point, the idea of whether this is a repeat of 2008 or not, I think that's getting a little bit too far ahead of ourselves. What we can say right now, again, what I said before, when we're looking at just the evidence, or, you know, what are the markets saying right now? What they're telling us is that there's something abnormal here, and that's something that's abnormal. It has been abnormal for a very long time, and it just keeps building and building and building to the point now where, you know, the mainstream is just now starting to notice, because it has to notice. So there is definitely something serious that's not right here. We know that it's something that has to do with the primary dealers. They're essentially, they are the big bottleneck in all of this equation. But what does that mean going forward? Well, it's kind of difficult to say right now. Nothing good, obviously, because, you know, the whole global economy has switched from globally synchronized growth to already what is a globally synchronized downturn, and maybe something worse. So it's already probably not a very good thing, and it's already substantial and serious. So, you know, while we can't say that this is, you know, another crash is coming or right around the corner, what we can say is that, you know, there's something not right here, and it's something substantial, and it's not something that officials, the government, the Federal Reserve, or any central bank around the world has any idea what it is or why it is.
Well, and we can go a little farther than that. What we can say here is we've got messaging coming out of people saying, look, you know, everything's rosy. Stock market is almost at all-time highs. We're looking at just a fantastic economic outlook. There's no problem. Yet the very most sophisticated actors in the entire system, which are the big primary dealer banks, cannot get their hands on enough safe haven assets. And once they do have their hands on them, they're not willing to sell them, even at prices that economically, based on the business they're in, rational expectations theory says they should be selling them at. That really paints a pretty darn convincing picture. The smartest guys on the table know more than me. They know something's coming. And I don't know what it is, but it sounds big, frankly.
Yeah. And I don't know if they're the smartest guys in the room, but they're the ones who see this stuff. They can see what we can't. And that's what we have to keep in mind here. You and I, you know, we're looking at this from the outside. Everything to us is opaque. We don't have the ability to go inside the real monetary system, this real euro dollar system, and analyze in real time what's actually going on. We don't know what counterparty B has in its inventory that's spooking counterparty A and all that stuff. But I tell you what, those dealers do. They know what's going on in the system, and they're telling us. They're giving us these signals. Hey, we're a little uncomfortable here. And so, you know, again, I say it's something that's abnormal. It seems like everybody is waiting for the next shoe to drop. And it's not something that, you know, the Fed is just going to dismiss it completely going forward. And they're not going to, you know, that's the important point about last week, was that, you know, even when they do have to deal with what's going on, they've shown they can't really deal effectively with it. When it breaks out, you know, I called it a dress rehearsal for a reason, because if something actually does break, you're going to get a situation that's a lot more chaotic and disruptive than it was last week. So, you know, there's a lot of important points here that need to be stressed, and a lot of it is just, you know, hey, there's something going on here, which has been our message for quite a long time.
Well, Jeff, our 15 minutes for this All-Stars episode is just about up now. And all I can say is this reminds me of when the TED spread blew up in the beginning of 2008. And everybody said, well, that doesn't make sense, because that would indicate, you know, that the banks don't trust each other and don't think anybody's creditworthy. And that's not true. So it doesn't make any sense. It's just an anomaly. Well, guess what? It wasn't an anomaly. They knew something. Feels to me like people know something. In any event, we're going to leave it there, folks. Be sure to stay tuned to your Macro Voices feed this week. We've still got a whole bunch more All-Stars appearances coming up. We've got Juliet DeClercq, Danielle DiMartino Booth, and Professor Steve Keen on deck for All-Stars. For Energy Week this week, we've got Dr. Anas Al-Haji. Art Berman is back from vacation. Art picked a heck of a time to take a vacation from the oil market. And we've also got Pat Hemsworth joining us. And Convexity maven Harley Bassman will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest on our Thursday night Macro Voices podcast. So stay tuned for all of that coming up this week. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.